Hello and welcome to Lit, a podcast for combating burnout. I'm your host, Kate Newberg, recording live from the mountains of Colorado. Yes, I am back from Peru. It was an absolutely wonderful time and a really good experience while thinking about the kinds of concepts I want to cover in this podcast. The one today is going to be all about disobedience. So in our last one, we started talking about it by covering a sweeping swath of human evolution, beginning with Adam and Eve as the representations of human evolution from hunter-gatherer society into the humans that we are today, who have created civilizations and stratifications of society and also art and beauty and soul. And we talked about how, along with the disobedience, the eating of the pomegranate, along with the rise of the ego and all of our woe, as John Milton said, all of our suffering, came the opportunity for free will. So it's that disobedience and the relation to free will that I want to talk about today. And it's going to be a bit freeform. Here's what my notes say for this. It's just bullets. It says disobedience, mountains, going against, since systems aren't created for fulfillment. And then I said, drop a hint about egoic systems. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So going back to Eve, we're going to talk about the free will and how free will involves a shedding of the ego. And we talked about the ego being a false self that's created by identification. So you have identification with your mind, with your thoughts. If you think about it, we have piles and piles and piles of things we identify with in our society. So personally, there's lots of things I could identify with. I'm a woman. I have a doctorate. I worked in a school system. I used to be a teacher. I'm a homeowner. I have a cat, and all these things. And if you look at my CV or my resume, like, oh, and I've presented at these things and I've published these things, like all those things can pile up to create a part of my identity, depending on how much I attach to them. And then if you just look at your daily life, you attach to thoughts, you attach to emotions. Throughout your daily life, maybe you attach to, it is crazy to me how often, at least for me, my to-do list will pop into my head. There's all these things I need to get done today. There was this really great piece of advice. I was listening to a speech from a woman, and she said she stopped making lists. She used to be an inveterate list maker, and she'd wake up and that's the first thing she would do. And then she would almost create this sense of loss and of failure from the second she woke up, because she would always make a list that had too much on it that she could ever fulfill. So she just stopped doing it, and she just trusted that whatever was important would bubble to the surface. And she said that's how she's been living her life. So imagine just even a shift like that, where you say, I'm going to choose not to identify with all the things I've decided I need to do today. I'm going to choose not to identify with my to-do list. I'm going to choose not to identify with my thoughts. And just that small act is a triumph over the ego. So there's lots of those. And then perhaps you identify with emotions. So I know sometimes I drive with people who get really angry in traffic, and I don't have statistics on this, but I have a feeling that road rage contributes to a lot of the misery in our society. And so imagine the choice to not identify with those emotions in traffic. I know it sounds really hard, especially if you're trying to get somewhere and it feels like wasted time. But imagine if if you just chose not to identify with those thoughts, that and those emotions, that would be a triumph of free will over ego. So when I'm talking about this, I'm talking about this idea of what does this have to do with disobedience? So the way our society is set up is there are certain rules. And one of the analogies I've been looking at a lot recently that I really like is by this guy David Brooks, who wrote about kind of a two mountain lifestyle, and I think he's coming out with a book. This is in the New York Times, and it's in he wrote a piece called "The Moral Peril of Meritocracy," and in this he uses a analogy of a two mountain lifestyle. And his idea with this is that for many people, they start their lives on the first mountain, and many people stay on what he calls the first mountain. And the first mountain, he says, people on the first mountain spend a lot of time on reputation management. They ask, what do people think of me? Where do I rank? They're trying to win the victories that the ego enjoys. So you can see that the first mountain is really based on identification with your trying to constantly find your place in the world, especially in relation to others. And that could take a lot of different forms. He talks about how lots of people on the first mountain get a lot of success. Like there's kind of this unspoken and even spoken, like rules, I'm making air quotes right now, but rules in our society where if you do all the right things, you go to school, you get good grades, then you go to college, and after college you get a good job, and you get a good job, and you a good job in this case means, I guess, something that you make a decent amount of money and that is in our society considered valuable, which again, I think I talked about this before, but our society is kind of skewed in the jobs that we consider valuable. Really what it seems to mean working in an office is kind of what that means, that's what's valuable in our society. So you get a good quote unquote good job, you make enough money, you find a partner, you have kids, you get a house, the picket fence, blah, 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 that whole thing, right? And that's kind of the first mountain that he's talking about. And in that mountain, you get to sit back and allow the rules of society to justify your existence in a lot of ways. You can say, oh, I'm doing everything right. I'm very well respected. There's, I'm living above reproach. I'm living along the lines that have been dictated by our culture of what is successful. And a lot of people spend their lives on this mountain. And I think a way to check just to make sure is this might be absolutely fulfilling to you. And I think just, you know, the assumption that that type of life isn't fulfilling, that's not mine to make. I think some people are fully happy and totally 100% living in good faith. And I'll talk about that later, but living in good faith and on, you know, living that life trajectory. However, given the number of people in our society who are on that life trajectory and who do feel a deep sense of unease or dissatisfaction or some sort of message, internal message telling them that is this it? Isn't there more to this life than what I've created? This was supposed to make me happy. Why aren't I happy? I'm doing all the right things. So like those types of questions that come up, the fact that almost 70% of Americans report that they are burned out makes me think that there's something about this, what David Brooks calls the first mountain, that doesn't really resonate widely with us. And there's something about that that I believe is related to the idea of disobedience. So going back, if you look at how many of you perhaps have seen adolescence, right? When you look at childhood, I used to work with middle schoolers, so I've seen a lot of adolescence and encountered a lot of disobedience. And I think that one of the coolest things about adolescence is that you can see them chafing against the established ways of doing things. And in a lot of ways, we don't know that we have free will until we go against what we're supposed to do. So as long as we're following the rules, and if you look at Eve, as long as she was following the rules, there was always a part of her that kind of wondered, am I actually choosing this? Because this is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is what people told me to do. And so that's always kind of a wonder of like, well, as long as I'm doing what people told me to do, can I fully be aware, can I fully be positive of the fact that I'm actually exercising free will? And one of the easiest and most immediate and obvious ways to indicate that you are exercising free will is to disobey, is to go against what you're supposed to do. So in many ways, even though it drove me nuts with my middle schoolers, I also really respected them because I saw that they were moving into that realm of free will, of really defining like, yeah, I know that I have free will because I am choosing this thing that I am not supposed to do. And in a lot of ways, with Eve eating the pomegranate, she was declaring herself a free human being. Along with free will, however, and this declaration of free will, comes the responsibility of creating your own identity. So suddenly, when you step outside of the confines that were created for you by our society, the norms that were created for you, when you step outside of that, you are suddenly thrown into this existentialist conundrum of having to define who you are. And this is what David Brooks calls the second mountain. And he says, the second mountain is a place where what he calls is something happened that interrupted the linear existence, I'm quoting him, that they had imagined for themselves. Something happened that exposed the problem with living according to what he calls individualistic meritocratic values, which are what he says defines the first mountain. He said some of them achieved success and found it unsatisfying. They figured there must be more to life. Some of them lost their jobs. He talks about hitting tragedies. But what he says there is that suddenly people, for whatever reason, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, found themselves in a place where that first mountain type of life was no longer going to cut it for them. And when they embarked on the second mountain, which he describes as really just defining and living the life that you decide you want, right? And it may or may not look different from the first mountain. It definitely feels different from the first mountain. But what he talks about is that those people are suddenly in the position of having to define themselves and create their identity. They can no longer just rest in the identity that had been kind of created for them by society and that they allow themselves to just get caught up in. So that comes with oftentimes a lot of, it throws us into what he calls the wilderness. So suddenly we're in a place where we have to develop and take responsibility for everything in our lives. And one of the things he says is that people get into this position because something cataclysmic happens in their lives. Maybe a horrible tragedy happens that causes the identity that they thought they had to just fall away. Sometimes they're pushed into it by like losing their job or getting laid off, and suddenly they're given this opportunity to create what it is that they want. Or sometimes, like with Eve, it's just this persistent, you know, and in her case, it was kind of the form of the serpent that was nudging her toward it, but he was touching on something inside of her that was just persistent. It kept coming up. It kept coming up. It kept saying, is this it? Is this all there is? What about that pomegranate? What about that tree? What's up with that? And sometimes it's just that the relentless beating of your heart, something in you says, I need to do something different. And you slide into it from that. But either way, to be climbing that second mountain, you need a lot of conviction, because the whole premise of free will, especially with existentialism, is that you are suddenly responsible for everything in your life. And the secret is that you always were. The secret is that even if you're on that first mountain and you're making do, and there's something in you that's unfulfilled, the secret is that you're responsible for that too. I myself, recently, I've been working in education for 10 years, and one of the things that kept coming up for me was this thought, this realization that education had these ostensible goals, that they were, that when you're in education, you're helping kids become adults and well-rounded, good people, and helping prepare them for what's next. And I kept feeling that there was something off about that. And the longer I stayed in education, the more I saw how the ostensible goals of education were not being fulfilled by the system. That if you were to take away all of the rhetoric of education and just look at the system, you would think that the entire point of the education system was to manufacture test scores. No school or district is really going to say that that's the whole point, or if they do say it, they're going to couch it in terms of the test scores are the things that are going to launch kids into being better human beings. But there's always a disconnect there for me. And at some point, when I began defining the impact I wanted to make on the world, I started to notice that it was really at odds with the things I was being asked to do in my jobs in education. And I slipped out of that role. In fact, well, I don't want to say I slipped out of it. But I chose finally to say, I can't be a part of this system. I can't be internal to this system because I don't believe in the outcomes. I don't believe in the way it's set up. And I left. And in doing so, I was suddenly what I think of as thrown back onto myself. Like in this world where I was building something from scratch, it was a time of immense creativity and joy and generative thinking, because I was able to really just blow everything wide open and say, what do I want to do in the world? But it was also a time of pure terror. And if I let myself get too caught up in it, I could have easily limited myself or tried to fall back on some of the first mountain ideals, because at least that is accepted in our society. And so along with defining yourself and choosing free will comes the responsibility of building your identity from what you really value. And I think that's one of the reasons a lot of people hold themselves back from getting on that second mountain. And when I decided to leave my job and create something new for in my life, I had a lot of people in my life. They had a lot of mixed reactions, but one of them that came up most often were people in my life said, "Oh, I wish I could do that." And it always surprised me when they said that, because they could. They absolutely could. There was nothing stopping them from doing exactly what I was doing except their own fear. And that fear is so deeply ingrained in our society that it stops us from, oftentimes, from taking a leap into something that could be the best thing we ever did. And something I want to note that is really important is that David Brooks says some people get on the second mountain and it looks, their lives from the outside look a lot like it did on the first mountain. Like maybe they don't quit their jobs. Maybe they don't move. Maybe they don't do anything radical, but something in them shifts to animate a different spirit that they are with which they're approaching their lives. For me, it turned out that I needed to change the form because my spirit had been pushing me to leave the form I was in and to create a form for my life that was much more in line with my ideals and my values and my integrity. For a lot of people, the form of their life is actually very much in line, but there's something about the spirit that needs to be reanimated or needs to be shifted. A good example for that could be something like, if in your first mountain phase you had kids, you're not going to stop being a mom or a dad on your second mountain. Right? You're still going to be a mom or a dad, and the whole second mountain endeavor there is reframing the idea of parenthood. If there's something about parenthood that became unfulfilling, right? Is there a way to reframe that position so that you see it as more in line with your values? So, what I'm kind of coming at is that the whole point of what I see as one of the biggest points of the Adam and Eve story is the fact that disobedience in and of itself is a very clear expression of free will. And along with disobedience comes the responsibility of taking responsibility for the consequences of your actions. But I think the other point of that is that, as there are hints in Paradise Lost, it really implies that they already had free will, that if they didn't eat the pomegranate, if they stayed in the garden, if they stayed on their first mountain, so to speak, they need to take responsibility for that as well. Because whether we like it or not, as conscious beings in this world, we are responsible for the lives that we lead. And we are responsible for the choices that we make. And what's so, I believe, transcendent about this is suddenly we're empowered to have control over the types of lives that we want to have and the types of experiences we want to have in our lives. So it sounds kind of crazy, but if you don't like your commute, and you don't like traffic jams, you have complete control over changing that experience. Either you figure out how to just not have to be in traffic jams one way or the other, or, and that would be form, or you change your spirit around being in traffic. instead of thinking of it as waste of time, you shift your experience so that you see it as, you know, sacred alone time to listen to your favorite book on tape, or to meditate in your car, or to observe the world around you in the present moment. And it sounds like, it sounds crazy, but it's also the alternative is just hating it, right? And hating it when you have a choice not to. So some of the things I want to leave you with here are ideas around, you know, what is it in your life that's creating suffering for you? And you don't have to, oh my gosh, don't go down the rabbit hole of like, you know, focusing on and making a list or whatever, but maybe pick one thing that you realize is causing you suffering and think about, you know, in this next week, think about how can I either reframe my spirit around this? How can I relinquish identity with this? Or how can I change it so that this isn't in my life anymore? And those are some really powerful options. And if you start to do that one by one with the things that are causing you suffering in your life, then suddenly you're going to find yourself in this state of freedom, and you're exercising your free will over your ego and over your life in a way that's extremely empowering. And in a lot of ways, that is a form of disobedience. Because the way our society is set up, it wants you, asks you, compels you to be identified with those forms. It compels you to be in this egoic state. Our systems themselves are representations of the ego. They have come out of this idea of ego. And the more we identify them and subjugate ourselves to them and allow them to define the ways that we live our life, the more we're abdicating responsibility for our own enlightenment. And so we can do this. We can disobey. We can exercise free will, and we can take responsibility for the things in our lives. Whew. So that, let's see. Let me go back. Disobedience mountains, going against since systems aren't created for fulfillment. And drop a hint about egoic systems. It looks like I covered everything. So this has been another episode of Lit, a podcast for combating burnout. I'm your host, Kate Newberg. If you have any questions about burnout, or you'd like to get in touch, please feel free to email me at kate@deeppractices.com. You can also visit my website, which is deeppractices.com. Great touching base with you all, and I can't wait to talk to you again next week.